You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Mickey. I see you have a guitar. Mickey?
Down by the... Whoops. Down by the river.
You sound exactly like Neil Young.
I shot my baby.
It's uncanny.
Down
oh my
by
God.
The
Are you Neil Young? What have you done with Mickey?
I shot my baby.
I'm getting like a free Neil Young concert here.
Well, Bob, I thought since Neil Young's off Spotify, I could become the go-to site for Neil Young music.
Totally. That's our new business model.
Joe Rogan has decisively beaten Neil Young on the battlefield of Spotify popularity.
Yeah, no, I don't see any problems with this approach to revenue generation, Mickey. Because it's like, you know, if you close your eyes, you just think, oh, it's Neil.
But you were probably rooting for Neil Young.
Oh, I'm ambivalent. Okay, so in case anybody missed this, Neil Young, in protest against Joe Rogan's giving a platform to Robert Malone and perhaps other vax skeptics, and according to Neil Young, providing misinformation that could get people killed, Neil Young has taken his music off of Spotify. No trivial sacrifice. Apparently more than half of his streaming revenue came from Spotify. And it's not nothing from Spotify's point of view, I'm sure, although it's not as big a deal as it would be if Joe Rogan left him.
Oldies are very popular these days, so it probably is some revenue.
No, he's got a lot of real fans. It's hard to imagine a whole lot of them switching to Pandora just for him, but you never know. I guess Pandora is the main rival still of Spotify, is it?
Beats me. I've never gotten into Spotify.
Oh, I use it, and that's where you got to go to get Rogan. I mean, you know, Spotify paid him like $100 million to have an exclusive on his podcast.
Yeah.
You don't have to pay for the podcast on Spotify, but Spotify is the only place you can get the podcast.
But I did, I'm continuing my name dropping week, Bob. I did see Neil Young when he debuted that song.
Really? You were the first time he played that publicly, you were there?
Not the first time, but before the album came out, he did a stand at the Troubadour and I snuck in three nights.
Uh-huh.
And he was really good. And I also saw him throwing up before the performance. So that was
That's even more impressive.
That was humanizing. The guy was nervous. He was nervous.
So you were using debut in the kind of secondary sense of meaning, not the first time it was done in public. That was what you meant by debut.
I don't know if it was the first time.
But tell us about
it was the first time I'd ever heard these songs, and they were fantastic. This was in the Everybody Knows This Is Nowhere.
It was the Mickey debut. You know, it's funny. I've been at the Bob debuts of all the songs I've ever heard.
Bob, but you're being pedantic.
I'm sorry. Well, then let's
querulous.
Let's cut to the chase. Tell us about the vomit.
No, he was just retching in the dressing room. At the Troubadour, you could sort of sometimes see into the place where the artists are.
Do you think he had been drinking, perhaps?
I think he was nervous.
Because he knew you were in the audience, probably.
Better than doing what Bill Maher does before a show. Never mind.
Not sure I want to know. Is that parrot room material? Do we have a first parrot room tease?
I don't want to know either. I like Bill Maher.
Oh, I want to know.
I keep thinking he might, you know, if he gets desperate enough, put me on his show. But no.
That could happen. That could happen. You'd have a better shot than
I would. He's going with Barry Weiss instead, Bob.
Oh, that's a little early for trolling. A little early in the podcast, a little late in the day.
Anyway, he was fantastic. The songs were new and fresh. Now they seem sort of old, but what the hell?
You know, one of his best songs is one of his least known. And it's going to be super embarrassing if this isn't a Neil Young song, but Long May You Run.
Yeah, you know what that's about?
It's about his car.
Bus.
Oh, a bus?
About his bus.
I thought it was about a station wagon with that wood grain. You know, what did they call a station wagon?
It was a bus. I think it had wood grain on the side of the bus. They sold the bus. They sold their tour bus, their beloved tour bus, I think, or something. Anyway, it's about their tour bus.
It's a great song. Pretty it's song, good. Funny song.
It's good.
Somebody hear me do it?
Sure. You may be better than me, so you may invoke the copyright police.
I'll do it in the pair room. I'm writing it down. Bob's debut of Long May You Run.
Scott Winship, who is much younger than me, who's a scholar at AEI, wrote that he's now older than every member of the Traveling Wilburys, except for Roy Orbison, when they were founded, which is truly scary.
I couldn't have told you that Roy Orbison was in the Traveling Wilburys. That's a little I know. But I will say this, Crying is a great song, that's the name. I wonder if that's Neil, Mickey. We got a little copyright issue he may want to bring to your attention.
No, it's Mike Kinsley. I'll call him back.
Oh, you should get him on. Anyway.
That would be rude.
That was a big name drop. That was your biggest name drop yet. Oh, it's Mike Kinsley calling. I'm sorry, Mike. I don't have time for you right now.
Well, I thought you'd be interested.
I am.
Okay. Never mind.
I see you haven't changed your screensaver. Your default, whatever that is. That's the factory setting thing.
Yes. I'm a factory setting guy, Bob.
Wait, but this issue, we should talk a little about this issue raised by Neil Young, right?
We should? Obviously, they shouldn't censor Joe Rogan, so...
Well, censor isn't the word. See, this bothers me.
They shouldn't kick him off Spotify.
Is censor the word? I mean,
punishing him for his, you know...
Can we agree?
If you take away $10 million from a guy, he's still free to talk, but you've punished him for $10 million, so that seems... close to censorship, unless he says something really awful.
Well, they'd probably have to pay him the money. He wouldn't lose any money. And then he could go to whatever platform he wanted if they actually did kick him off. But we agree, I assume, this is not a First Amendment issue. It's not censorship in that sense, right?
No. Right. But it's
censorship in the sense that censorship his mother's brothers complained sense. About CBS censoring them.
Right.
Is what it would be. I don't know. I mean... they're both using their clout. It's Joe Rogan versus Neil Young. Let the best man win. I'm afraid it's not going to be Neil Young. But I mean, I don't have an objection to Neil Young doing this. I admire it. He's sacrificing a lot of revenue. And
I agree. I don't, I wish his music had been better in the last three decades, but what the hell? It's noble of him, but I don't think he should have won. How about that for an opinion?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a view on who should have won. Cause again, it's all fair play. I mean, it's not like the government censoring somebody. And
you know, in a society where people are constantly like threatening to pull the stuff. And so it's a constant war. I mean, we could have wars for the next two decades like this.
But, you know, it's kind of always been implicit.
You're a Trumpist, and I will pull, you know, all of a sudden, like Bruce Springsteen pulls all his songs because they let a Trumpist on Spotify or something. Just a bad president.
It's entertaining. Yeah. What else is there to do?
Bob, this
life
is what,
so boring now that Trump is gone.
This is, well,
all
life
we have
is
a pandemic. What?
Life is grinding to a halt. I'm very worried that at some point we'll run out of things to talk about.
I'm worried about that this very week.
But not this week, Bob, because I think I've used this before, because you know what this is?
That is a picture of, it looks like a statue of somebody with an inscription. It's probably something said.
I was walking around DuPont Circle and on P Street.
Is that Mr. DuPont?
No. In P Street, there's like a lot of statues. There's this little statue of Masaryk, the founder of Czech democracy. Mm. And there's this giant fucking statue. And I wonder what it was about. And you know what it's about? It's about?
Joe Rogan?
It's about Ukrainian independence.
Oh.
It's been up there for two decades, and it's about a Ukrainian independence leader from the 1800s. This has been going on a long time.
They were seeking liberation from the Russian Empire at that point?
I know that Peggy Noonan has criticized people who say, well, it's been going on a long time, so we shouldn't intervene. But it's been going on a long time, and it's like not like you know, not like it's a struggle that will go on for a long time. So I think that should, you know, this isn't like the last stand against Putin or the last stand against Russia. And if they reach some sort of muddled compromise, that's not the end of the world. It looks like Russia is pulling back a little bit now.
I guess. Let me just insert the observation that I'm a little surprised. I'm totally fine with going to Ukraine. I can talk a lot about it, and I'm a little surprised you're putting this ahead of Stephen Breyer's retirement. But
that was number two. But I figured we'd get Ukraine out of the way. You know.
Okay, but you know how it is with Ukraine. Once you get me started,
I mean, my basic line, okay, let me have my own. There's just not that much difference between the peaceniks and the neocons on this one. Most of the neocons don't want to send troops, at least troops to Ukraine. They want to give aid and they want to have sanctions. They want to deter. But most of the peaceniks are willing to deter too. It's just unlikely to work. So what's the big fight about? The fight is about attitude more, I think, than concrete actualities of what you want the United States to do.
It depends on what you mean by peaceniks. I think a lot of people you call peaceniks are not enthusiastic about sending weapons in. You know, the weapons thing is just a kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, if it succeeds in deterring Russia, fine. But if it doesn't, it probably winds up getting more people killed. So that's a slightly tough one.
The Ukrainians' call, isn't it?
I am in a way on the hawkish end of the peaceniks, just in the sense that because I do put so much emphasis on international law and invading would be violating international law, I'm much more amenable to economic sanctions in this case than I would be if it were some internal affair, which is usually what we're doing economic sanctions about, which I don't approve of. I mean, I would say, though, that the downside is if you wind up, you know, we're talking about some pretty powerful combination of sanctions. If you wind up doing those, then not only have you kind of shot your wad in terms of future Russian misbehavior, but there's less and less. You have less interdependence, and so you have less leverage of that kind in the future.
I mean, I guess. I went searching for the neocomposition. So I read Ann Applebaum's Twitter feed, and I read David Frum's Twitter feed, and none of them want to send troops. I read an article by Ann Applebaum's husband, the former defense minister of Poland, who's very hawkish, and he doesn't want to send, you know, actual U.S. troops to Ukraine. He wants to send weapons, which I agree is a little controversial, and have sanctions. And so he's just not that much different. The only difference I can see is that people like Russ Douthat and me, and I assume you, are willing to actually give a substantive carrot along with the stick of the deterrence.
That is where the difference is, yes. So I think the
carrot would be, you know, some wink and a nod, you know, we're not going to let Ukraine in for 25 years or 10 years or however much, you know, and have it be a sort of informal, deniable, but real agreement. I don't see why it can't be a real agreement. What do we have to take? NATO has to take every country that wants in? No, they don't.
No, of course not. I mean, that's the absurdity of saying this is about Ukrainian sovereignty, as if any nation has the sovereign right to join NATO. NATO is an organization that can decide who joins it. Yeah. You know, I agree that the big difference is in terms of what you would, you know, what concessions you would give to defuse the situation. And that's a very stark difference, I think. I think there are a lot of hawks who would not abide Biden saying, well, okay, you know, I can't quite, since I'm not going to be president for 20 years, I can't quite guarantee Americans' policy then, but I'll get together with these other members of NATO and say, we have no intention of expanding NATO for the next 20 years, something like that. Now, I think I've come to think that, and this was, I think I had, this occurred to me while probably I was talking to Anatole Levin on the podcast, on Tuesday's podcast. He's a Russia expert at the Quincy Institute. I think the hope is to enlarge the conversation and like get a bigger deal. Because if it's a narrow deal, if it's like, okay, in exchange for you not invading, we're gonna pledge to not expand NATO or not expand it to Ukraine or something, or do this or that, that's hard for Biden politically. That's very hard for him politically. I mean, I don't mean necessarily in terms of grassroots blowback, but, you know, the blob will be all over him. And whereas the more other issues you bring in, I mean, there's, you know, the more both sides can say, well, we got this, this, and this. You know, this can be the disposition of missiles, either in Russia or in within NATO. And one thing Anatole mentioned is, you know, you have, I think I've got it right, that you still have these unresolved kind of parallel situations in Kosovo on the one hand and Georgia on the other. You know, in both cases, you know, one thing that Russia objected to that we did was bomb Serbia in 99 on behalf of a Kosovo independence movement. Russia then did something kind of comparable, some people think partly in retaliation, in Georgia, in intervening on behalf of separatist republics. It was south of Osetia and something that starts with an A. I think all those are unresolved. We have not come to an agreement on any of those about what the status is.
I thought our cover story was that Milosevic, the Serb leader, had violated the Rambouillet Accords, which we had crammed down his throat. Or maybe he'd refused to sign them or something. I don't know.
Beats me, but I think even... I think there's something approaching a consensus that it was a violation of international law for us to bomb.
I think he hadn't. I mean, we were very full of ourselves and thought we could bomb people into doing all sorts of things.
Not only that, this was done under NATO's auspices, okay? This was like at the same time, this is right when we're starting to expand NATO, annoys the Russians, and we're saying, oh, and by the way, NATO will bomb whoever the hell we want to bomb. Oh, well, that's a nice combination of news.
Well, it's weird. I mean, make it broader, fine. But if you look at, there's this weird thing in the news, which is they say Russia has to move as soon as the ground freezes, okay? Because then the ground is firm for their tanks. Right. And it hasn't frozen yet, thanks to global warming.
Is that right?
So they're waiting for it to freeze.
Well, then they've only got a few weeks.
It thaws in March. So they got a window of like a few weeks.
And they don't want to spoil the Olympics in China, right?
So you're not going to negotiate this wider wheel deal in time for this narrow window of opportunity to forestall it. You got to stick to a simple. And anyway, Lavrov has said today that what Blinken proposed has some rational parts to it. So that was, he must have proposed some sort of concession, right?
He hasn't made it public. I don't know. I don't know what it means. It may just mean that Lavrov is himself trying to get Putin to cool it for a while. Who knows?
He couldn't go off the reservation like that.
Well, no, but I mean, he may be talking up any Biden quasi concessions to Putin. Right. You know, I one thing that occurred to me is I wonder if Putin didn't, in a certain sense, stumble into this situation where it's hard for him not to lose face. What I mean is, you know, when people first started noticing these troops massing, one speculation was that it was a deterrent to keep the Ukrainian forces from pushing back the borders in the civil war. I mean, remember, in these two republics or whatever they call them, Donetsk and I guess Luhansk or something, the rebels don't even occupy all of those two places, right? They haven't even extended rebel control to the western bounds of those. And I gather the Ukrainian forces were showing signs of wanting to make a serious push. And one thought was that at that point, Russia was putting forces there to say, don't even try it, A, and B, to intervene if Ukraine did try it. Right. And then, you know, naturally, everybody in the blob started freaking out. And apparently the U.S. to this day is more freaked out than the people in Ukraine. They're like, I doubt they'll do anything. at least more of their elites are saying that than our
Publicly,
elites.
Yeah.
And then once we started freaking out, I wonder if Putin didn't say, well, as long as they're terrified, why don't I make some demands? You know, like, it wouldn't surprise me if he kind of backed into this, this situation. I don't know.
It's Jack Schaefer wrote a column about, how the wag the dog scenario was bogus. The idea that Biden was ginning this up because his poll ratings are low and he want, you know, war would increase it. I didn't even know that there was this rumor in Washington. That's how out of it I am here in Los Angeles. I didn't even know that people were saying that Biden was wagging the dog.
I hadn't heard that.
But Putin may well be wagging the dog. I mean, Putin if you read some people, they say, well, it's almost inevitable that in contrast to what you say, it's almost inevitable that Putin would make a fuss about Ukraine now because they were turning toward the West. His popularity is declining. He has to distract people.
You got to remember there are these issues in Ukraine that any rival of Putin's who wanted to play the nationalist card could exploit. And by the way, Navalny is himself something of a nationalist. People assume that Navalny is like made in our image and, you know, but he has a past of being something of a nationalist. And you got to remember, Ukraine is kind of pushing the Russian language out of the schools. They are shutting down Russian media. I guess they might say because it's propaganda, but Russian language media outlets have been shut down by Ukraine. And it's easy, I gather, to stir up a popular sentiment in Russia on behalf of ethnic Russians or Russian-speaking Ukrainians who, in their view, are you know, losing rights in some sense or another.
It's weird. There's a bakery here that sells Ukrainian pastries or Russian pastries. They don't think they made, and there's a big sign there apparently that says Russian spoken here. And I thought it just meant that if you're Russian and you happen, you know, they'll talk Russian to you. No, it is a specific Ukrainian thing. That's what the Russians put on their bakeries to mean we're Russians, not Ukrainians. Fuck you.
Really? So they're actively alienating some customers.
I think so. Yeah, the vast Ukrainian population in Los Angeles, but it's not the benign sign that you think it is. And that's been going on for centuries too, since this guy in 1840. You wonder Putin hasn't called up reservists yet. I don't think that's apparently the key sign. Mm-hmm. That he's serious.
Although there's a headline I just saw a couple of hours ago where Pentagon declares that Putin has amassed all forces he needs to invade. Yeah. Let me check it out. Russia has enough troops in place to invade all of Ukraine, Pentagon says.
This right winger named Kurt Schlichter, who I don't usually agree with, wrote a very good column about how, I mean, nobody's talking about it, but how we shouldn't intervene militarily. Because we suck militarily now, and why show the world that we suck militarily at this particular point?
What's the evidence that we suck? I mean, we've had some pretty
When was the last time we won a war?
Well, that's because we keep going to these places where war is really difficult because a lot of the people there don't want us there. I mean, if you're going to try to occupy a country where a lot of people hate you, yeah, that's tough. But if on the other hand we were to intervene on behalf of a bunch of Ukrainians who were happy to have us there, I mean, not that all Ukrainians are, but I mean, if we didn't like try to occupy Donetsk or something, you know, I don't know.
He goes into the usual stuff about, you know, we're spending time putting pronouns on the military letterheads instead of training the troops, and also there are other stories that the Russians have gotten much, much better.
That is apparently
and modernized their weaponry, and so it's not clear that we want to go head to head at this particular point.
Oh, I know, I don't. I think, and there's a lot of different ways Russia could do a military intervention if they wanted to. I mean, I assume they're a little leery of sending in tanks because we've given the Ukrainians pretty sophisticated anti-tank weapons, but they could just sit back and at almost zero risk destroy a lot of the Ukrainian military from the air.
I do. He the other, what Schlichter said, and he said, look at a map, look at where Kiev is. And I looked at a map, and you look at where Kiev is. It's very close to the Russian border. All that's separating it from Russia is a big fucking lake.
Well, wait.
It's a huge lake. But
No. Kiev has a lot more than a lake separating it from Russia.
I mean, it seems to be on a lake, and the other side of the lake is Russia. The lake is very long. So, or whatever, no, that's whatever not, body that's of water is there.
You mean heading directly east from Kiev?
No, heading north from Kiev.
Oh.
Anyway.
Okay.
Russia could capture Kiev pretty easily. The question is, what do they then do with it?
I got to Google my little map.
It does seem to me that, you know, it may be in the U.S. interest for Russia to invade and then get bogged down, and it's a disaster for them, and their soldiers start getting shot in the back and killed, and it's another Afghanistan for them.
Mickey, that's a big lake, and it leads not to Russia but to Belarus.
Okay, Belarus.
There are Russian troops in Belarus, but my guess, you know, everybody keeps pointing out how many Russian troops are arrayed to the north in Belarus and everything. My guess is that's a distraction. That forces Ukraine to diffuse its troops all along the border. Right. It's a no-cost thing for Russia. Just put some troops there and suddenly you've thinned out the enemy. Yeah.
Well, Schlichter is a former soldier and I'm not, so he seemed to think it was an easy strike. But what about this bog down? I mean, that's another reason why this may not be the end of the world. I mean, so what? So they invade and you know, the idea that they're not going to transform Ukraine into a Russian-speaking country. I mean,
look, I don't think they're going to try to take Kiev. They could conceivably bomb military installations in that area. I think the most they try to keep in any meaningful sense is way east, you know, possibly the land bridge between Crimea and Donetsk, and probably push the rebel-controlled area of Donetsk and Luhansk out to the full extent of those like provinces. But
did you write about this week?
Yeah, Monday I wrote a piece that actually got a certain amount of play. It was about how we got into this mess, and it was and then today's newsletter will have probably a little item on, but the long Monday piece was an argument that if three presidents in a row, Clinton, George W. Bush, and Obama had bothered to look at things from Russia's point of view, they would not have done the series of things that got us into this mess, beginning with expanding NATO, which Kennan himself was against, the architect of containment.
Is it in no way at the fault of George H.W. Bush? Did he do everything right? I remember a member of the Bush administration said, I think we overdid it. As well, the H.W. Bush administration. So,
well,
why are we letting him off the hook?
I think you can trace, in terms of NATO expansion, to Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. That's the first round, if you don't count Germany itself expanding. I think you can kind of trace the very origins of those wheels being set in motion to the very end of the George H.W. administration. But look, it didn't happen. The invitations weren't issued until 1997. Bill Clinton could have easily derailed it. It picked up momentum during the 90s. There was a committee to expand NATO run by a guy who was from Lockheed Martin, which the arms makers made a ton of money off of this, because once a country joins NATO, its armaments have to be in alignment with NATO specs, right, which means you got to buy them from the same companies that built the original weapons. And so, you know, it was a big boondoggle, and Clinton, you know, and lots of people, Bill Bradley was warning against it. Again, Kennan was, a lot of people were, and what Kennan said is exactly what happened. He said, Russia is going to react adversely to this. And then people will say, see, this is the way Russia is. The Georgia intervention is a good example. That was probably part that came. I mean, it was maybe partly payback for Kosovo, but it came like 4 months after George W. Bush issued the invitation to Georgia, the quasi invitation to join. It was just all unnecessary. I haven't heard a single good argument for expanding NATO.
I agree. My one further point, and then we can either switch to Breyer or I can sing again.
Let's go with Breyer.
You never know. I wonder if all these people like Fiona Hill, who were saying, you know, Trump, it was unfortunate that Trump, you know, interrupted our support for Ukraine with this phone call to Zelensky to try to get it, sick him on Biden. I wonder if they regret now making a huge deal of it in a way that cost Ukraine a whole ton of Republican support. If they hadn't made a huge deal of it, people like Tucker Carlson would have a lot less traction on the right in terms mm-hmm. of getting people to not take Ukraine's side on this. And it was just, it was incredibly stupid of them.
I hadn't thought about that. You'd know more about those politics than I would. I think not the much. Upside from their point of view is support from the resistance. You know, all these liberals who see Fiona Hill as a hero because of her testimony during the impeachment, and see, you know, Bill Kristol as a hero because he joined the resistance early, and Max Boot and all these people, you know, these are the people who don't want to give the kinds of concessions that you and I would want to give. They now command a lot of support among Democrats, among liberals who don't pay that much attention to foreign policy, but have the world divided between good guys and bad guys. And the good guys are the ones who hate Trump.
Good point.
And I would have
that's
thought
a very
that,
good point.
I would have thought that Tucker would have been singing the kind of non-interventionist line in any event.
He would, but would he be getting traction?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Mickey, okay, well, I see something disturbing. You've picked up your guitar again.
I thought I fucked it up before, so I thought people want to hear.
They want to hear the better version?
Down by the river.
I shot.
Anyway,
podcast.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's our bumper. That's our musical bumper.
Yeah, I'll my people can talk to your people about that.
So, well, I don't have that much to say about Breyer. Well, I have a couple things to say
right,
about
just
Breyer.
Just quickly, one thing about Zelensky, this the president of Ukraine. Yeah. I mean, first of all, remember his qualifications for president. Or that he played a president on TV. I mean, literally.
Apparently very well. It's supposed to be a hilarious show.
That's not nothing. Not nothing. Okay. I mean, that's at least as relevant as Trump's performance on Apprentice. But we saw how that worked out. Anyway, he says, I don't quite understand the logic of this. He says he was quoted an interview with Lally Weymouth. You know her probably, of the Washington Post.
I met her.
You met her. Okay. Anyway, he says, today, our partners are saying that war may start tomorrow if there is a powerful escalation on the Russian side, and then there will be powerful sanctions applied. Now, he says, but if we are talking about the sanctions policy and the probability of escalation, then the question is, why are you not introducing sanctions now rather than wait until after the escalation? I have an answer.
You say it destroys their incentive, but yeah. What if the incentive is, If you don't invade, we'll take the sanctions off.
Yeah.
So
I guess that tends to be there. A harder thing to do politically, taking sanctions off. And the world is full of examples, but maybe that's what he has in mind.
There must be some rationale behind that demand. I didn't quite understand that either. But
so
it's very odd. It's very odd. It is this odd situation where they are much calmer about it than we are.
Apparently. I mean, there are multiple reports of that. Some people call it stoic resolve and don't make it sound like they're minimizing the chances of invasion. And some people make it sound like they're minimizing the chances of invasion.
Well, they've been invaded before, so maybe it's not such a big deal to them.
Right.
I mean, it's a big deal, but it's not such a big deal.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, also, they probably know that the Russians are not going to try to occupy Kiev, you know, not going to happen.
One theory is that they would encircle Kiev and issue demands.
A siege. It's been a long time since we had a good siege.
The one thing they're clearly not going to do is try to occupy the countryside. That would be a recipe for death. basically.
Well, you know, so. even in Eastern Ukraine, you look at the map and the Russian speakers are concentrated even there in the urban areas, and the rural areas, you know, not so much. So I think even that might be dicey terrain. Even those two republics in the east might be dicey terrain for Soviet troops. I mean, Russian troops, if they were to hang around. I don't know.
I mean, if you really were anti-Putin, you might want to encourage him to take the whole country. See what you can do with it, buddy.
That's what Tom Friedman said in his column on this.
Yeah.
Of which I was critical in my newsletter piece, in the Non-Zero newsletter. Yeah. But he was a good sport about it, and we've scheduled a podcast conversation.
Really?
Yep.
You've beat me on the name-dropping front. I better catch
up. Thank you. Oh, wait. Tom's on the phone right now. Mickey, I'm going to put you on hold.
So we can't quit Ukraine, but let's quit Ukraine.
Okay. Breyer retired. A lot of great rhythmic headlines came out of this.
Well, it's very weird. Breyer... Usually they retire in March or April or June, you know, and all of a sudden when Biden needs something to do, he's been losing. There's a lacuna. There's a vacuum of victories. He desperately needs a win, something to talk about other than build back better. And all of a sudden, Breyer sort of moves up his retirement 3 months with a conditional letter of retirement. He says he will retire if a replacement has been nominated and approved by the time the court ends its term. Well, is that a retirement? He's saying he'll retire if X happens. X has not happened. So how is he retired? How is there a vacancy?
Wait, isn't there kind of a catch-22 here? I mean, does he want the person to be installed before he retires?
Yes, it's a total catch. It's a total catch-22. Usually they say I retire as of June 1st, and then it's not his business whether whether Mitch McConnell has managed to stop a nominee. Mm-hmm. Under his theory, if McConnell blocks a nominee, he's still on the court. He doesn't retire. Where does he get off doing that? I don't understand. And did somebody whisper in his ear, if you really wanted to be a good Democrat, you would announce it now and let Biden have a couple months of, nice talk about where we consider a lot of nice black women nominees for the Supreme Court and rally the base, and McConnell looks obstructionist. And clearly, if the Republicans are smart, they won't make a big deal of it. They'll say, okay, it's not an important vote. It's not a swing vote. It's replacing a Democrat. Yeah. Let's move on.
But could somebody like Manchin get in the way?
Why would... You mean Manchin would object? I very much doubt it.
I mean, if he didn't like the candidate.
I think it's much more likely that a couple of Republicans will go over and give him 51 or 52 votes or 53 votes.
Now, you know who my choice is among all of the black women who could do this job?
I know nothing about any of them.
Guess who my choice is? I'll give you a clue. This could be the first step in a strategic masterstroke that helps the Democrats hang on to the White House in 2024.
You have Sherrod Brown have both a sex change and a race change operation.
No. Does the name Kamala mean anything to you?
Oh, I know you're going to say that, but he's already ruled that out, I think.
His press secretary did.
But it's pretty, that was immediately speculated.
Shocked. I thought only I would think it up and it would be kind of a joke. But people were, because I mean, she has been Attorney General of California, not nothing, but still she's a little thin on the credentials.
Right. But her forte is legal argument. That's the only thing she's good at.
The one thing you see Supreme Court justices doing, which is interrogating lawyers often in a hostile fashion, she'd be excellent at.
And so what? She's an automatic vote for the left, like the same way all these other people are. It makes no difference at all. Our clerks write the opinions. It's actually a much better idea than I thought when I first heard it.
It's a great idea. Then it takes her out of the heir apparent position. Then the only other thing we have to do is convince Biden not to run, and we can have an actual free-for-all and get a candidate with an excellent chance of beating Trump, which I don't think Kamala Harris has.
Or you could get rid of Biden and go straight to Pelosi. That was my strategy.
Well, Pelosi would Pelosi become vice president automatically if Kamala went to the Supreme Court? No.
But she's next in the line of succession.
What would happen?
I think what happens is
wasn't Ford Speaker of the House when he became vice president?
I think what happens is Biden then selects a vice president who is approved by. There's an amendment that deals with that. That's how we got Nelson Rockefeller. Remember?
I had forgotten.
Ford picked Nelson Rockefeller as vice president.
That's shocking.
I think there's a provision for that. But before that happens, Pelosi's next in line of succession. So if Biden quits, she's president. That would be my plan. The problem is people hate Kamala so much they want her to leave the national scene. They cannot stand the sound of her voice, and we don't want to ever have to hear her.
You don't have to hear that much from Supreme Court justices. They don't even televise the proceedings. You got to go. You got to show up to hear them. It's a small room. I've been there.
It's a better idea than I.
It's a great idea.
I thought of when I first heard it.
I think this explains why, much to my surprise, Washington was talking about. I think there are people thinking along the lines I'm thinking. Get her a safe distance from the White House. That's job one if you want to hang on to the White House.
People are desperate. The presidency of Harvard, what would it take? But I just thought it was using the Supreme Court as a turkey for him. But it would be.
I'm also not sure.
The Supreme Court, I think, has been used as a turkey for him before.
Do you think she'd want it?
I think you'd make her an offer she couldn't refuse.
Well, anyway, aside from that, I know nothing about these candidates, and I'm sure they'll be fine.
It just seems there's something weird about the way Breyer did this, and it seems, political, not in an evil way. But
he didn't quite do the catch-22 thing, did he? I mean, he didn't quite say.
He says, I resigned when the court rises at the end of this session, assuming a successor has been nominated and approved. So if that to me says that if McConnell, which he won't do, but if McConnell manages to delay the approval till past June, there is no vacancy.
Well, McConnell can't delay it, can he? You can't filibuster this.
Correct. There's some weird theories that which seem to not have a majority opinion. One is Larry Tribe's theory that the vice president cannot cast a tie-breaking vote on a nominee. Now, that there was an article in the Boston Globe that was paywalled, so I didn't read what his argument was, but he has apparently reaffirmed it. He said, I'm not a hypocrite. Harris cannot vote to break the tie. So if it's 50-50, then it's delayed. The other theory was that they would have trouble getting her out of committee because the committee just split 50-50 and there's no tiebreaker. And to bring it to the floor, then Schumer would need 60 to somehow get it to the floor. Nobody seems to buy this theory. This was the theory in Time magazine. So there are a couple of dissenters who think that McConnell can stop it.
Now, there's also,
why would he? Under my theory, he wants to make as little fuss about this as possible. Sluice her in there, fine.
Yeah, I mean, also, do they have no shame? I mean, surely they wouldn't pull another bullshit after all the Supreme Court justices. After what they pulled with Obama, and I don't know.
It seems to me he's allowed to say, if this nominee is too radical, we're going to oppose her. And if the nominee is, not that radical, to force a more moderate choice. I mean, that's why there's Senate confirmation, is to force a more moderate choice. So without the filibuster, if it's 50-50, you have some leverage there.
But there's a pretty good chance that the candidate will be someone that Tucker Carlson can whip up a lot of indignation about.
Well, actually, if my theory is right and the Republicans are trying not to make a fuss about it, Biden wants to nominate somebody radical enough to get their dander up. So he doesn't want to nominate somebody totally uncontroversial. He wants to nominate somebody just controversial enough that the Republicans have to make a fuss about it.
Wait, what does that accomplish from his point of view?
this is good publicity for him. It's better than talking about Build Back Better and his other failures. It's, you know, and it mobilizes the base and we'll eventually win. So he wants to goad them a little bit to make it a fight. I'm sure he won't have a problem with that. But there are also all these Republican organizations that are going to try to make money off this by opposing it. So it won't be that hard to goad them into a fight, even if they try to stop it. But he wants somebody just radical enough to piss them off.
I mean, Biden can't catch a break. Did you see this headline in the New York Times? Pittsburgh bridge collapses hours before Biden infrastructure visit.
He's talking about infrastructure.
I know.
It's collapsing like around him. It's obviously they need the bill.
Hours before. I don't know.
I think it was perfect for him. And the other thing is David Dayan wrote a very good, we're inevitably drifting into Build Back Better territory. But he said there, you know, one of the things the Democrats can emphasize now is onshoring productive capacity. And there is a bill to do that for semiconductors, which is up before Congress. The Senate and the House versions differ, but that's a winning issue for him. So he has mentioned that in his speech. So I think that's the first, I think Diane is right. The first step for a comeback is emphasize this onshoring thing, which will get some Republican votes. Certainly going to be popular, more popular than the massive bureaucracy increasing things that the Democratic interest groups have stuck into the Build Back Better bill. So talk about that. Omicron recedes, the pandemic recedes. Those are two big planks on the Biden comeback trail. And this, you know, this winning filling of the vacancy is number three. Three is a trend, Bob. It seems to me he's on the way back.
Well, I just think a lot of it hinges on COVID, you know, and I think there's a tendency for people like you and me to overthink the whole Biden popularity thing and talk about, like, where did he go wrong? And, you know, like Ross Douthat wrote a column analyzing this a couple of weeks ago. And like, you know, we act as if when he makes a big deal of a voting rights deal and it doesn't pass, oh my God, that's a huge setback. I mean, most people don't even know that happened. What they know is their lives are miserable because of COVID, and there's just a limited amount.
I think they know that he's let Representative Jayapal sort of.
Are you serious?
Set the agenda. They know he's caved too much to the left. That he had this big bill and it flopped. That it was a big liberal bill that was going to transform America.
Wait, seriously, Mickey, if you gave Americans a test, Jayapal is a town in Pakistan, B, you know, so you think they'd even get that right? Are you serious?
I think they know he's spent a lot of capital pushing plans from the left, and that they were supposed to be transformative in ways that the voters didn't quite understand and maybe didn't like. And that they failed. And the question that Douthat tried to address, I assume, and it's a legitimate question, is why did he do this? And there were all these, there's all this attempt to pin the blame on Ron Klain somehow because of his, you know, his sucking up to Representative Jayapal. And they don't make sense to me. There's a ninth planet there. Why did Biden do this? And the obvious answer is Jill. Jill is the ninth planet here that nobody is talking about. Well, what you got a better reason? Nobody can explain it. Why did this guy who his entire life has been standing stiff arming the left, okay, on busing, on various things, on crime, all of a sudden he becomes pursuing to his detriment. And his poll numbers are really awful, Bob, to his detriment, pursuing this strategy with the left, this sucking up to the left or letting them have their way instead of putting them down the way you know Bill Clinton did with welfare. Why is he doing this? It can't be Ron Klain.
But wait, there are two.
Got to be somebody who is as much power as Ron Klain, but isn't Ron Klain, and that person is Jill.
But there are two competing theories here. I mean, some people are saying, I guess what you're saying, he was trying to move much farther left in the country once. And then there are people who say the mistake is not to try, but to fail. He just looks ridiculous because he tried
to
do this.
They're both the same. At some point, he should have told the left, look, we're not going to pass these five big things. Let's pick one of them and pass it. And he didn't do that. Even now they're all talking about, now Jayapal is talking about, well, we have to rebuild something that Manchin could want. And what's he going to want? He said he wants pre-K, okay?
Yeah.
But Jayapal is adding childcare and elder care.
Yeah.
He hasn't said he'll approve childcare and elder care. So even now, when they're paring it back, they're not paring it back. They still want four of the five things. It's insane.
You see this watch I'm wearing?
It shows we've talked for an hour?
No. You know what color? What color is the band?
Silver.
Not exactly. But the point is, I didn't want this color band. But because of the supply chain thing, the only way I could get it at MSRP and save $50 was to get the band I didn't want. That's why Biden's in trouble. Everything about our lives is out of kilter because of this fucking pandemic,
including the
color of my watch band.
That's right. And instead, and he isn't addressing it. Instead, he's addressing the Build Back Better agenda. People know that. People know he's not putting his capital on
now they're trying with, you know, free tests and so on. But I just don't think any of that will address it either. I just, you know, having free tests doesn't mean that suddenly all the food is back on your supermarket shelf. And people really are going to the supermarket and not all the stuff that used to be there is there. That's just a major problem for any president.
Very hard to find disposable coffee cups at my supermarkets these days. They're all cleared out.
Is that a plug?
This is a Megadown mug.
Oh, are we doing some name dropping here, Mickey?
No, but I've been using this fucking mug without washing it for several days now. Because I usually use disposable mugs. Can't get them. Anyway, the other weird irony, there were two important studies that came out. One, mm-hmm. The Manchin has said the one part of Build Back Better that he'll accept is universal pre-K. And there was a devastating study that showed people who went into states pre-K did worse than the people who were denied it. Now, I don't, and there was another one that seemed to show that about the child tax credit, which we can get to, but these are supposedly like blind random assignment studies. But you random assign a study in the social sciences, it's not like, you know, in medicine where you take a pill and you don't know if it's the real pill or the placebo, okay? And they see what happens, okay? You know that you have been denied entry into the pre-K or not. There's no way to make it completely blind. Now, people seem to buy the study's design and think it was a terrible death blow to pre-K. So just when it's the only thing that Democrats can pass, this study comes out and says, no, you're making things worse. I'm not so sure that it's not subject to some sort of methodological argument, because there was some evidence that the people who were denied entry into the government pre-K actually went to better pre-Ks. They went to like Perry preschool style pre-Ks that were better than what the government offered. So I'm not sure that it's the final word, but
I mean, you'd think they would test only the kids who didn't go to pre-K at all, right? Although that might have
you probably have sort of a biased sample. Anyway, it's ironic that the study comes out showing that the one thing Manchin agrees on actually sucks.
Well, I just think I wonder if the reason you're looking so hard to find flaws with this study is that you're afraid that if a pre-K dies, child tax credit will fill its place.
No, I'm always worried about that. But no, I'd be happy if pre-K worked and we could pass it.
I'd be okay if pre-K died and was replaced by free community college. But keep
in mind that the other aspect of pre-K that they didn't test is the fact that it frees mothers up to work. And I'm all for parents working. And also there's this tension, okay, and it's within the Biden administration, but within everybody's thinking, which is Is mothers staying home and taking care of their kids? Are they teaching them better than the government would if they were in daycare or if they were in pre-K?
Right.
And people, a lot of people on my side suspect that with a lot of these very poor mothers, in the Biden administration too, and they've said this explicitly a couple of times, the kids are better off in childcare and in school than with their, you know, mothers, because the mothers really aren't that good mothers. Okay. And nobody
I
dares,
assume you're trying to
nobody,
find
nobody dares say this, but there is that is a strain of thinking. And the other strain of thinking is we want to have a child tax credit to free up the mothers to do their mothering, because that's the best. It's like mother's milk. It's the best thing for the kid. And
well, oddly, this study could give some support to that view. Right. That one interpretation would be the kids who didn't go to kindergarten got more time with their mothers.
I want to see this segment of the study directed at single mothers and maybe it's single non-working mothers. See what happens to see if it's not better. The study is all low income people, but it doesn't distinguish between working parents and non-working parents. So I think there's still a possibility that for a certain subsegment of mothers, it's actually better to send their kids to school. But I don't know. But they didn't test it. I didn't see it broken out that way. Anyway, there was a study hyped by Jason DePaul, although very responsibly, in the New York Times, that's obviously political, that seemed to say that the child tax credit improved the brainwaves of people who got it. In other words, if you give people $300 a month as opposed to $30, and you go with a portable, brain scanner to the houses of these kids, the kids that got the $300 a month had more of the good kind of brainwave than the kids who only got $30 a month. And there are two responses to that. One is
it's complete bullshit. What's the other one?
Well, one is you send the person who's doing this field test of this kid, he's not blind. He or she's not blind. They know if they're testing a kid that got the money or didn't get the money. And these people are desperate for a positive result. So maybe there are little ways to skew the meter so it turns into a slightly better result. The results were very modest.
Well, kind of brainwaves are these anyway? This sounds so hokey. What kind of
brainwaves
are
there? There's a good brainwave and a bad brainwave. And the kids had... The bad brainwaves were the same. So there was no improvement for the $300 a month for the bad brainwaves, but there was a little bit more of the good kind of brainwave. And so one of the theories is they obviously skewed the results because they were desperate to, they were desperate to come out with a positive result time to when the child tax credit was up before Congress as it is now. So,
well, I mean, the other, if you're, thesis is that the experimenters could be loading the dice. The other way they could be doing it is just in the way they're treating the kids. I mean, who knows? Maybe your brainwaves are affected by whether the experimenter says, "Oh, come here, Johnny," or "Get the fuck over here, Johnny."
That's a good point. There are all sorts of.
This just sounds like such bullshit.
But the other line of attack, which sort of contradicts this line of attack, is, of course, money produces better brainwaves, a little better brainwaves.
Oh, I don't.
I bet if you looked at people who make $100,000 a year, they'll have better brainwaves too. And $200,000 a year, they'll have even better brainwaves.
Yeah.
And this is so of course you'd expect some minor difference, but we don't know how important it is. Does it translate into cognitive? You know, they didn't measure actual cognitive function. They just measured brainwaves that are traditionally associated with good cognitive functions. And the other thing is it tends to, in even reading this one study, it tended to saying, you know, we're permanently fucking up these kids. These kids are permanently fucked up because they're poor and they're not getting this child tax credit. Well, at some point, if you follow that line of thought, kids being permanently fucked up because they're poor, you wind up with Richard Herrnstein saying, okay, these kids are permanently fucked up. They're doomed to a place in the social structure. It's sort of hopeless to expect them to rise to the top. So poverty runs in families like bad teeth, and you could see them, the liberals, sort of resisting this the Herrnsteinian implications. But but they're there, and you push this sort of people are fucked up in their brains light of argument far enough, you wind up saying, okay, these poor people are so fucked up, we can't expect them to go to Harvard. You know,
this sounds like parrot room material, and coincidentally, we are at the 1 hour mark exactly. I do want to say,
I've made that point now, and
I'm not sure we have any new parrot room material there. I want to emphasize, I'm not denying that you could have positive outcomes from a child tax credit. I'm just skeptical that this brainwave test would tell you anything meaningful. But
I think the brainwave test is it reeks of political bullshit to me. Yes.
Yeah.
But other people said, you know, the results weren't modest. They were just you couldn't tell if they'd actually achieved those results. Jason DePaul said they were modest. So he was being responsible. He was trying not to hype it while he was giving it national publicity. Fair enough. Anyway, I think the study has been sufficiently iffy that it is not going to turn the tide in favor of the refundable child tax credit, but I could be wrong.
Now, is there anything we should say about COVID before we talk about what we're going to talk about in the parrot room? We haven't spent much time on COVID. But I don't,
You know, Bob, that's just the sort of bullshit you usually throw. You're really,
you'll have to elaborate.
You're really what a son of a bitch, you know? I'm adopting the new tone that Joe Biden is supposed to adopt toward the press.
Oh, is he?
Is the sort of the fuck you emergence of fuck you, Biden. Because he told this Fox reporter that he was a stupid son of a bitch.
Did he tell him that literally?
Yeah, it was a caught on a hot mic.
But it was off mic. It wasn't. He didn't.
But the mic was hot. Everybody heard it.
Yeah.
And this was immediately said. Oh, this is the new Biden. This is the great new Biden. Okay, this is going to work for him. He put down the Fox reporter and the new combative Biden that's revitalizing. Executive discourse. John Harris wrote a column in Politico, but other people have said it too. So I'm trying to adopt this new. There's fuck you, Biden. There's going to be fuck you, Mickey. Yeah,
you did that very well.
How's it working for me?
No, it was good. I think you could be president. That was good.
Fuck you.
I don't think dissing the press works for a Democrat quite the way it works for a Republican, though. Did you say fuck you or thank you? I thought you said thank you. You said fuck you?
I said, fuck
well, even better. You're getting better. You're growing into the job, Mickey.
Thank you.
So wait, some things we could talk about in the parrot room.
Okay.
You want to know some?
Sure. I've sort of shot my wad, but I think I have a couple of things in reserve.
Okay. You're going to talk about, I hope, the unknown scandal about Kamala's husband, Doug Imhoff.
I've never said that. I was waiting for you to pressure me.
I'm pressuring you.
I will open the kimono a little bit, as it were.
Oh, that reminds me. I will say a little more. I'm going to write this down about this War in the Pacific trilogy I've been reading.
I can't wait. Fuck you.
Yeah, exactly. This week is the 50th anniversary of Robert Trivers' paper on parental investment and sexual selection. So I'll naturally talk about that. I would like to play guess the Lou Reed verdict with you. I hope you didn't see this thing that I saw on Twitter where they quoted Lou Reed, you know, you're this big Lou Reed groupie, Velvet Underground, things Lou Reed said about various performing artists, his verdict on like the Beatles and blah, blah, blah. You didn't see this, I hope, right?
No.
So I will give you the test. Did Lou Reed say good things or bad things about this person?
Oh, you're not going to say, did Lou Reed actually say this or is it apocryphal?
No, I'm going to say, did he give him a thumbs up or thumbs down? Then I'm going to read you what he actually said about them.
Okay.
He was critical of no small number of rock and roll artists.
That's great.
I will say. I'm going to talk about a piece called Let's Talk About How the NFL is Failing While the NBA Reaches New Heights, which is about the number of black coaches. Although my main comment is on headlines that start with the words Let's Talk About, which drive me nuts.
I like the more pretentious what we mean when we talk about.
What we mean when we talk about love. Raymond Carver. Was that the name of it? No, what we...
It's me. You're blowing it.
What we talk about when we talk about love. We'll talk about Raymond. Bob, you know, Raymond Carver's an interesting story. I'm going to talk about Raymond Carver.
You stupid son of a bitch. You're blowing your cultural credential.
Mickey, I love it.
You got to know the title of the Raymond Carver story if you're going to deploy it.
What we talk about when we talk about love. I think that's it. But anyway, I'm going to talk about Raymond Carver, you know, his whole, the whole Gordon Lish thing, you know? You know, the whole thing. And my brilliant, unappreciated
tweet. Not the whole Gordon Lish thing, I hope.
The whole fucking thing. The whole Was his name Gordon Lish? Was that Raymond Carver's editor's name? Anyway.
Yes. He had this bevy of extremely attractive and actually very good female writers.
You can talk about that.
There was a fictional novel called Elbowing the Seducer written about that.
Man, the thing is, it's hard to find something you don't know more about than I do. You know, I try.
Well, my mistake was when I tried to write a novel of my own.
Yeah.
For some reason, for some idiotic reason.
I think I know what
reason,
the mistake was, but go ahead.
Some idiotic reason, I chose Elbowing the Seducer as my model, which is it's a very sort of mild and effective form of irony and humor, which I am unable to achieve. And why did I do that? Why did I do that? I'm an idiot.
You dumb fuck.
We're getting into it. Okay. You're not being Pete Ducey, though. Pete Ducey rolled with the punches. So you got to let me abuse you and then slough it off.
Is Pete Ducey the reporter that Biden?
Yes. Yeah. Called the stupid son of a bitch.
Fuck you.
I
want to say a little more about Meatloaf. I was maybe a little unkind to him. I want to talk more about the song Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
We have substantive things to talk about. We have affirmative action we haven't talked about. It's about to be thrown out by the Supreme Court.
Right.
There was something you wanted to say about Bill Buckley that you didn't get to say last week.
Well, I want to get you to say what you didn't say about Bill Buckley, which you told me afterwards. Or I'll be discreet. I'll be discreet. I won't push you any farther than you want to go. Okay. But let's just say it does involve.
We have the cancellation of the week, which is
never mind.
Cancellation of the week, which is Ilya Shapiro.
Who's that?
He's a libertarian legal scholar who Mark Joseph Stern of Slate tried to get fired.
Hmm.
I know which side I'm on just by. Well, I actually don't know which side I'm on, but I am on that side. Are we living in a simulation?
I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the metaverse.
Metaverse. Yes, the metaverse.
The metaverse is drawing us into the Matrix.
Okay, we can talk about the metaverse.
Metaverse, Matrix.
There was a video of Mark Zuckerberg made of a sort of mini metaverse that was.
Well, that's a video from a couple of months ago that drew widespread ridicule.
I don't know. It has this woman saying it's strapped to my face and she wanders around and she puts a mustache on herself.
Yeah, that's the one.
It like made you run screaming. Yeah. There's a little bit of Henry Cuellar stuff.
Didn't we talk about him last time?
Right. He's just on my list. There's some Soros prosecutor news. There's some BLM news, some bizarre BLM news.
Ooh.
There's my paranoia about why Apple is delaying putting our podcast up, Bob.
It's a good question.
And it's not because my rendition of Neil Young is so perfect that it triggers the copyright computer.
Let me say, this is a good point. Apple, and we're not the only podcast this has happened to, the right show sometimes is hours and hours late on Apple, on the iPhone feed. There are two solutions. One is to buy an Android phone, which I recommend. It's not a problem on Android. The other is to, for some reason, it's not a problem with the Blogging Heads feed, which the right show is also on iPhones. So if you're on an iPhone and you think it's time for the right show to show up on Friday night or Tuesday night when a different a show, unfortunately, deprived of Mickey's charm appears, then you should try the Blogging Heads feed. And that's the end of my, thank you.
There's a,
I mean, exciting, we've listed a lot of stuff, Mickey.
There's an exciting election in Portugal, Bob.
We may have to jettison that one.
And I have some things to say about money liberalism.
I fear we're about to hear musical accompaniment.
Bob?
Yeah.
Down by the river,
I
shot my baby.
I went to patreon.com/parrotroom and Mickey's newsletter, Cows Files, and Bob's newsletter, Non-Zero. And the Twitter feeds, Robert Ryder and Cows Mickey. I just almost have no more promotional things to say, Mickey.
Yeah. Dead, I shot her dead.
Oh, well, follow me.
Perfect segue. We'll see you in the parrot room.